Christoph.
Thank you. So sorry that this session starts with a big disappointment. Thomas couldn't come here. And we decided actually quite a few weeks ago that we should swap it. And apologies to everybody from Thomas and all the best greetings. He couldn't make it from Berlin here, so he asked me to give this talk. I actually worked together with Thomas. My name is Christoph Bostel. I worked with Thomas for about 5 years in Berlin before I moved to Slack, to the LCLS, about a year ago. But we still collaborate also now on the LCLS experiments, so I hope I can get you equally excited about clusters and intense X-ray pulses. And what I basically subtitled my talk is going from about 100 nanometers to 0.7 nanometers to see what we want to learn is how actually do clusters react to intense soft X-ray, like X-ray radiation. And the talk is outlined as follows. I will first introduce and motivate our work a little bit. I will then talk about spectroscopy of clusters, which has mainly done at the flash free electron laser in Hamburg, and then also about single shot imaging of clusters that we have done in Hamburg and flash and also at LCLS just actually a few weeks ago again, and before I come to the conclusions. As this conference is, to my understanding, mostly in the intent of this conference is mostly to trigger discussions, I also decided to put a lot of data in here, especially towards the end, that is more or less brand new and that we still don't really understand or that came as a surprise to us. So I hope you have a lot of questions, and most likely I will not have an equal amount of answers, but I'm looking forward to the discussions. Why do we want to do work on clusters? So the ultimate goal, or one of the grand visions of actually work with free electron lasers, of course, structure determination with hard X-rays. So the dream here, especially about the Henry Chapman, Janosch Haido collaboration is, or many other actually also in the field is to, but they made this nice picture, to drop a single molecule into an X-ray beam, hit it with one single pulse, and then kind of get a faint or like a single shot diffraction pattern that is rather broad, and then use all kinds of computer algorithms to orientate the molecules and to reconstruct the molecules. But of course, as we also learned in the previous talk already, is that you're fighting basically with the damage in this molecule. You basically, it will Coulomb explode. One of the not yet as much discussed issues, of course, is also, as Linda pointed out, you will have a lot of electronic transitions, so there's also something that will be called or can be considered electronic damage in these molecules, and these will also affect the scattering efficiency of such structures, and I will come back to this later. Another thing why we're actually interested in clusters is that we also want to look at fundamental questions about radiation-matter interaction, and this is just a quick comic that I partly stole and partly made a long time ago. So basically what happens if you go from the infrared field, which is rather well investigated, to the X-ray field is that your frequency changes. So basically going from the infrared to the UV sources, basically your Keldysh parameter starts becoming much larger than one, and the ponderomotive energies go down significantly from about 10 to a few keV in the infrared regime, depending on your power densities, to just a few milliEVs in the UV photon source and negligible effects in the X-ray regime. But what's new actually here is that you will have a direct ionization process also from core levels, and because you ionize core levels, you will have also lots of secondary processes such as fluorescence and Auger decays. Why do we use clusters? We actually think clusters are very interesting model system. They're actually very easy to make. They're like monoatomic, if you, or you can make them also mixed, but in first degree only have one element in there which you can choose. And they actually are very interesting. Nano lab, they have something, or they have densities comparable to bulk solids. There's no energy dissipation into any surrounding media because they're just a single cluster in the gas phase. And then, of course, by tuning the cluster size, you can also investigate the intra versus interatomic effects. So basically, you can go from one atom to two atoms to 10 atoms. You can see actually if there's any collective effects or any effects that that are basically due to the fact that you have an extended system. The questions again, actually, what are the mechanisms of absorption ionizations? What are there any nonlinear effects, or what effects are there for absorption and emission, and what are the timescales actually of electron emission and ion motion? And the experiments actually that has been done in 2002 in Thomas Müller's group, and then we did a lot of experiments at flash from 32 to 13 nanometers, and now actually at 0.7 nanometers at the LCLS. This is the flash facility in Hamburg, just a quick overview. You basically have an accelerator that's in this hall and then extended in this tunnel, and this is the experimental hall. In the phase one, basically, it was working around 100 nanometers, and now in the phase two, it's in the wavelength regime from 5 to 50 nanometers, a few 10 femtosecond pulses, and 20 to 150 microjoule pulse energies. Upgrades are currently underway, and I think Flash is coming back into operation as we speak, basically, with an upgraded accelerator, so they can also reach far above 200 EV now. The second set of experiments has been done at the LCLS, my new home, basically where we have an injector at the 2 kilometer point of the 3 kilometer LINAC. So we basically inject the electrons here, we accelerate them to a few GeV, we transport the beam in the in what we call a transfer line to this area where the undulator hall is. The main reason is the undulator hall is in a tunnel under the mountain, so it's easier to air condition. And then we have the so-called near experimental hall. We have three experiments running right now, the AMO end station, the soft X-ray end station, and we are commissioning the X-ray pump probe end station right now, which basically is the first one who takes the hard X-rays. They've seen first light and they're ready for users' operations in October. And then we have the far experimental hall. We have three more hard X-ray experiments, and we're also talking already about upgrading this whole machine to LCLS 2, so hopefully we have some more news about extended capabilities in the future. I also want to point out that actually just yesterday the official LCLS paper came out, first lasering operation of an angstrom wavelength 3 electron laser, and it's mainly authored by Paul Emmer, who is the leading brain, I would say, from the accelerator group, and who is together with John Galeiter, I think, had the largest impact in making the whole LCLS work. So what I'm doing now, actually, in the next few slides, I'm just kind of going through some older and published data already, which is mainly spectroscopy at flash. So they started out at 100 nanometers, doing the first experiment in the sub-optical regime, basically for shorter wavelengths than the optical regime. And what they saw there is that they saw extremely efficient Coulomb explosion of the clusters. And the model that was developed there in the over the course of a few years is basically that you had a very efficient inner ionization because the photon energies were just at the ionization potential of the xenon atoms. And those were xenon clusters. So you had a very efficient inner ionization. You had single photon absorption in the clusters. And then you could also perhaps get charge-enhanced ionization by barrier suppression of the neighboring atoms. This nanoplasma that developed here was then heated in the FEL pulse rather efficiently still with inverse Bremsstrahlung or plasma type absorption processes. And then the electrons were driven out of the clusters with a thermal electron emission, and the cluster most likely expanded geometry, and the cluster kind of exploded, or Coulomb exploded. Open questions remain, such as were there any neutral excited atoms still left in this interaction, but as the machine was shut down basically after these experiments and upgraded to Flash 2, that's all the data we have. However, there was quite a few experimental papers and a lot of theory that I think led to a rather consistent picture by now by Jan Michael Rostrow in Sandra, the Braverk group in Canada, and also Beata Ziyaya from Hamburg. So I think this is rather well understood. So what we look forward is doing the first experiments at flash in about 2006, I think, where we just decreased the wavelength by only a factor of 3, going to 32 nanometers. But here, this is the experimental data in a solid line. We have not seen any indications anymore for electrons that are faster or that gain additional energy any additional energy, but from the direct photoionization process. So what you see here, these are argon clusters, rather small argon clusters of 50 or 100 atoms. And here's the argon main line. This is just the photo emission peak in the low power density regime. And then if you increase the power density, you basically see this this background or this signal growing towards lower kinetic electron energies, And the explanation we had here is that this is just a series of single ionization events, basically, that you get the first photoelectron out here, the main line, and then you get more and more and more photoelectrons out. And the peaks get broader and broader just by the fact that it depends on where does the second photoelectron start with respect to the first one. You get a little different screening, and you get a little different coulombic energy due to the electron or to the hole-hole interaction or electron-hole interaction. So if you add this up, just a Monte Carlo simulation, you can explain this the sloping background rather well. And I want to point out actually that similar results have been obtained at the free electron laser source in Japan. Basically, they came to the same conclusion, and there's also been more theory done by Beate C. Ayer in Hamburg. So the take-home message is here. We can explain the data in a pure photoelectron picture. We don't need any plasma heating process anymore. So basically, it's even if we own it down by a factor of three in wave in photon energies, of up a factor of three in photon energies, down a factor of three in wavelength, we seem to have come to a fundamentally different processes in ionizing these clusters, which is basically just photo emission. The next important step was actually that we reached the 13 nanometer or 90 EV barrier, because here for the first time we could reach core levels in xenon. And there's actually also been a lot of, I just want to point this out, typically I have a paper popping up here which basically refers to Matthias Richter's work, who has investigated the ionization of at 30 nanometers in xenon atoms, but he's also here and he's also giving a talk later, so I skip this part, as you will hear from Matthias Richter about it. But the interesting thing is we have the so-called giant resonance here in xenon at 90 eV, which is due to very efficient ionization through a large overlap of the filled 4D and empty 5F orbitals, which is an auto-ionized. So it's a very high ionization cross-section. And if you compare xenon clusters to argon krypton clusters, we also see that in xenon we can ionize up to 9 plus easily, whereas argon and krypton we actually go to 5 plus and 4 plus only. If you now go into more detailed analysis of the cluster work, actually this is pristine clusters, we see actually that we ionize the cluster very efficiently. We get very high charge states out, but to explain the Coulomb kinetic energies that of the ions that are coming out of this cluster, we see that we actually have to make certain assumptions to be able to model these ions. And the assumption here is that if you have a large cluster, we actually need to assume a rather neutral core, and then to get the high charge states just from the surface. And the smaller we make the cluster, we actually get less and less high charge states, and we just get a mediocrely charged core, basically single charge core. We have done a second experiment actually in core shell systems where we basically took a xenon cluster and decorated it with argon. We can see if we have a thin shell of argon on xenon, we still get a we can kind of suppress the high charge states of xenon. We get larger xenon fragments, so we don't completely destroy the cluster anymore. But we also get a nice argon peak, basically rather highly charged argon. If we make this argon shell thicker and thicker, we actually get significantly increase in the argon kinetic energy release. As you can see, this peak is growing, this width of this argon peak is growing with respect to this width. And we can completely suppress the xenon, which basically means the xenon is recombining in the inside of the cluster, and we only explode the outer parts of the cluster. So here, from these two experiments, we basically can conclude that there seem to be secondary recombination processes in the clusters. You seem to get rid of the high charge imbalance by exploding the outer ions on the cluster surface, and then you have recombination processes and so on and so forth going on the inside in the cluster, basically also turning the Coulomb explosion that's typically observed or let's say, while typically, I guess for these size clusters in the infrared, you observe a complete Coulomb explosion. And what we see here is that we have a Coulomb explosion of the surface shells, and then just something like a hydrodynamic expansion of the cluster core. One thing that always struck us, however, is we have this very high ionization, or we have very high ionization cross sections, and we create a lot of electrons. But the multi-step ionization process in these clusters should saturate pretty quickly, and it's easy to calculate the multi-step ionization, and we always seem to need more charges to explain our kinetic energies, our Coulomb explosion in kinetic energies, than what we expected from the multi-step ionization. So we talked to our theory friends in Dresden, in the group of Ulf Sam and Jan-Michael Rost, and about this. And we also saw, if you go to the electron emission of xenon clusters, we showed them our data, and they came up with this brilliant idea that actually you have more effects than just the multi-step ionization in clusters if you actually go to the case of xenon, because you create a very high superatomic density plasma. So basically, you have many, many free electrons you create. You have a high ionization cross-section, you have OG decays, and so on and so forth. But you basically have many electrons per atom in the plasma. And what I show you the data here real quick, what we observe, or what puzzled us in the beginning, and then how they explained it. I think also Ulf Sahmann will talk about this later this week, so I just keep it brief. We have a photoelectron spectrum here at low power densities. This is the 4D emission, and here's some OG electrons. And if you go to higher and higher and higher power densities, we basically increase this tail towards higher energy, so something we have not seen at 32 nanometers. And the idea is that we basically create a lot of free electrons in the plasma. They have energy exchange and collisions, and they kind of thermalize, or they go into an electron plasma distribution. So you basically, like, by just hitting them with energy exchange and collisions, you basically get an electron distribution that tails off to much higher energies than your photon energy is. It's about 1,000 atoms, I think. Okay, and here is actually the calculation from Ulf Sahmann, which is very nice. That's the time-resolved calculation, so you have a 30 femtosecond pulse, approximately. You see when the pulse starts, actually is set. So this is the time of the electron activation, basically, and this is the electron energy. So what you see here is the multi-step process, which kind of saturates. So it basically, or not saturates, it frustrates. Right, so you don't get the electrons out here anymore, and then you still create more and more electrons. They exchange the energy, and you get this tailing electrons, which can be driven out of the plasma here. Okay, so because the peak of the pulse in theory is always at the zero, so basically they, instead of going from 0 to 30, they go -15 to 15. And again, this is and yeah. Okay, but I'm pretty sure actually, and this will actually, I think, come out this week, and I think Ulf will talk more about this later. Where's Ulf?
What's the elastic mercury
It actually, I mean, it's larger than the cluster. So the problem is the electrons get trapped in the Coulomb potential, right? So they can still fly out, but they come back in, and then they scatter, basically. So it's kind of it's extremely highly excited plasma, basically, with a few 10 eV electrons, or basically the excess energy of the photoemission process. Okay, now I actually come to the second part, or to the second third of the cluster of the talk, which actually our scattering and imaging experiments. In the beginning, we did the scattering and imaging experiments at FLASH, where we built our own university-style detector, so it was just an MCP, basically, with an activated front, and then a mirror, and a phosphor screen on the back, and then a mirror, and then an out-of-vacuum CCD camera. It worked really nicely. We could get nice single-shot images at the repetition rate of flash with this machine. And here are just three examples of similarly sized clusters, actually, from about 0.5 to 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeters. That's the power density the actual cluster has seen. And what we see here is actually that the signal grows significantly, and especially at the outer parts or at larger scattering angles, the signal grows a lot, and actually non-linearly compared to the incoming power density. So we increase the power density by a factor of 10 here, roughly a factor of 10 here, and actually the signal here to the larger scattering angles actually increases by a factor of 30 to 50 somewhere. So we were, first of all, very happy that we could see the structures. We can also see that actually if you go to higher and higher power densities, we see some structure out here, which may be like some six-folds or some higher-folded symmetry already from the cluster surface and so on and so forth. But we are mostly interested in actually what kind of electronic information is this experiment carrying. So if you think about it a little further, a scattering signal is basically a photon in, photon out experiment. So the whole scattering signal is generated during the duration of the pulse. And then also the scattering signal is a function of the optical contents, or actually the electronic structure of the cluster while it is illuminated. So basically this is an experiment that is really over when the pulse is over and it's not prone to any secondary effects such as recombination or electron emission in the Coulomb potential, whatever that all the spectroscopic techniques are subject to. So we do rather simple modeling actually of our scattering data with Mie theory. So Mie theory basically is you have an incoming wave, you have a scattering matrix, and you have a scattered wave. And then you have this in the scattering matrix, you have some, you basically, it's only dependent on the refractive index of your particle and the size, but we can get the size out of our scattering data. And then the refractive index is coupled to the atomic scattering factors F1 and F2. So basically, we can basically bring down by doing this modeling, we can like correlate the scattering signal to very simple or to the most basic actually atomic scattering factors that are also to the atomic scattering factors. So, and what we do here is basically, this is just a couple of calculations here. Basically, if you like change the atomic scattering factors, what's the biggest effect is actually that you change the slope of your signal or of your scattering signal, especially if you increase the absorption, right? So basically here we have very low absorption, the ground state of xenon, and if you drive the absorption higher, for example, just you will see why we do this in a second. You basically see that the slope changes significantly. And what we've seen here now, this is actually from similar pictures as I've shown you before, is that we see actually power density dependent changes in the scattering profiles. So here the dots are actually the data, and the detector actually saturates down here actually, so we disrespect the signal below a QR of 10. It's a detector saturation effect. But what we see here is if you actually have rather low power density, we can fit with a single set of atomic scattering factors our data really well. We get a slope of Q(10^-4), which is basically also called the Porod's law. So it's what could be considered classical scattering of a spherical object. But if we increase the power density, actually we see that the slope of the scattering data, especially in the high QR regime, is significantly changing. We need actually two sets of QR of atomic scattering factors to explain the whole the whole profile, and we basically also made sure that the detector is not saturating here, so that's all good from an experimental point of view. We really need two profiles here to explain the low and the high actually QR regime. If we now take all this data and we plot it, we see actually that the biggest effect that we see is in the imaginary part of the refractive index, basically F2 or the atomic absorption, and the scattering factor delta is basically rather constant here. So the real part of the atomic the real part of the optical constant is we don't really seem to see a strong effect of the power density, but definitely in the absorption. What interestingly, it dips first below the bulk value and it seems to skyrocket about 3^10^13 watts per square centimeters. And what we do is actually, because we do both, we do spectroscopy and scattering. Of course, these are two different cluster sizes, but the story is expected not to change too much. In general, the effects that I'm making aware of right now is that actually when the signal seems to go up a lot here, about 2^10^13 watts per square, or low 10^13 watts per square centimeters, this is also the appearance power density for the xenon 4+ in the clusters and also in the atoms actually. So this point here where we really see a strong change in the scattering signal is correlated to the appearance of 4+ in the ion spectra. And now we go back and look at the synchrotron work, and we actually see that the xenon plus cross, or the cross section, actually especially at our excitation energy of 90 eV, first drops a little bit from xenon plus to 2+, and so, and this is also the drop we see in the scattering data, right? And then actually if we start having the plus, we drive this resonance into our photon, the xenon 4+ ionization resonance into our cross section. So we have a very large cross section ionization. We actually believe this is what we see right here, that we create a xenon 4+. There's a huge cross section which also goes back into the scattering process, and we can just kind of to some degree map the electronic structure of the cluster of the nanoplasma with a scatter, or that we see a change in this in the nanoplasma, or like the creation of the 4+ significant levels of 4+ in the scattering data. So we think actually that the scattering itself is a very promising or very interesting approach to do to probe the transient states of the cluster. So basically something that you cannot really see if you just do spectroscopy, because you're always prone to secondary effects on the ultrafast time scale, and because it's basically a photon in, photon out technique. Coming to the last third of my talk, of my presentation real quick, it's what's called dynamics in clusters. That is how our LCLS proposal was called. This is actually a collaboration with my old group in Berlin. So these are all the students and Thomas Müller, of course, and also the Max Planck Advanced Study Group, especially Artem Rudenko, Daniel Rollis, and then two grad students, Benjamin Erk and Benedikt Rudek, and the whole CAMP collaboration, basically. We also use the CAMP chamber, which Joachim Ulrich introduced earlier. We have a focus, so this is now work at LCLS. We have a focus in the CAMP chamber of about 45 microns squared. The CAMP chamber has been here old experiments that we can do basically imaging and photon particle and particle correlation experiments, meaning we have one cluster in the focus of the spectrometer. We look what's coming out of the cluster after we excited it to the X-rays, and we can take the scattering pattern at the same time for one cluster in a single shot. And it's a very flexible setup. So as we will see, there will be, we have seen experiments already this morning of electron holography in the setup. Now we work on clusters, and John Spence will talk later on about, later in this week, about imaging of biological samples also in the system. The one result that struck us now, basically what we can do now, because we measure the scattering pattern and the spectra at the same time, is that we see a huge effect on how we hit the cluster basically on the spectra. So as you can see up here, that would be just what you measure as an average TOF spectra, like an average EinTOF spectra. And down here you see various single shots, or three single shots basically, that give a different intensity scattering signal. And what we do now is we use the scattering signal to sort basically, to sort how well the cluster has been hit, because it's a single particle experiment now, so it doesn't really matter anymore what your gas detector tells you about how much pulse energy the LCL has delivered. But it's much more important actually where has your cluster been in the focal volume. So here we basically have a rather weak shot, a mediocre shot, and a very well hit. What we see here is that the spectra changes a lot compared to the average spectra. So here for the very well hit, we see a lot of high charge states up to this is krypton right now, up to about 30+. And if we actually have a weak shot, we see a distribution of the charge densities towards lower charge states, right? And this also holds true for xenon, actually, which is the next one. Here, it's the nice thing. We do actually have a real xenon spectra here, taken at a different experiment or at a different end station in the collaboration with Janosch Haider and Todd Dittmeier. So this is now a real ensemble average spectra of xenon. So you see what we saw earlier, a large a xenon plus peak, basically the monomer, and then some high charge states in their distribution. If you do the experiment basically as with the scattering as a feedback, okay, thank you, we basically see a strong monomer peak. If we get a better shot, we see basically a monomer and high charge states. And if you see a very high, if you get a very well shot, we actually only almost the only high charge states, which was or is actually very surprising to us, basically. Because what happens is, or this is our simple model right now, our current thought. So what happens? We come in with the pulse. We immediately excite. So that's a 20 nanometer radius cluster, about 800,000 xenon atoms you have seen earlier. We immediately excite a very dense electron plasma, basically, and a lot of electrons are removed by just the multi-step ionization, which frustrates very quickly, but also by perhaps the plasma or by the collisional ionization I talked about earlier. Then we have a charged surface layer, and basically because the electrons are removed, and then this surface layer explodes off. But what's really interesting now is if you have a very well-hit cluster. So the model until now was that we explode off the surface cluster, and then the rest expands and kind of ionize, or like recombines, expands in hydrodynamic expansion, so on and so forth. This is where you see a strong monomer signal. But again, I wanted to remind you that we didn't really see any monomer signal anymore, which is a mystery to us right now. So this is some food for thought. And the second experiment we have done actually just a few weeks ago, and this is also still to be analyzed in more detail. We did an infrared pump FEL probe experiment where we pumped the cluster with an infrared pulse of about 10 to the 15 watts per square centimeters, and then we banged it with a FEL pulse and we tried to take the scattering data off it. And what we were hoping is actually that we could drive the cluster and we could have it expand and then image its expansion in time over the course of a few picoseconds. But what we actually saw, this is the experimental setup, so this is just the LZS beam coming into the cam chamber. We coupled the infrared beam also in with a mirror with a hole and basically just had it crossed it here with a cluster beam, got rid of the second CCD back here, and just put a lot of effort in getting both beams out without generating too much stray light. And I skipped this. This is an experimental technicality, basically, that we got 20 micron spatial overlap and right now about 100 to 200 femtosecond precision in overlapping the FEL and the infrared pulse. And post-analysis underway will hopefully bring this jitter down between the both pulses to about 50 femtoseconds. So, but again, right now, just remember it's about 200 femtosecond jitters on the data. And coming back to the data now, so what we was hoping is that we could see the cluster kind of exploding, but what we really saw is that basically we just see the scattering pattern fading, right? So we have a very high excited nanoplasma with 10 to the 15 watts per square centimeter, 50 femtosecond infrared pulses that pumps the cluster very hard. It's a very highly excited nanoplasma, and then we come with these delays. We come basically with the X-ray pulse in 70 femtoseconds, about 10 to the 16 watts per square centimeter. So it's also a rather invasive pulse. It's not like a pump probe experiment where you just probe the system. It's also invasive to the system. But again, the scattering the scattering pattern that we should get out of that we wanted to see that it's always similar invasive. So what happens is we have 0 femtosecond delay, meaning within a 200 femtosecond jitter, we see a very nice scattering pattern on the detector. If we increase the delay to about 200 femtoseconds, the scattering pattern starts fading, it gets weaker, and at 500 femtosecond delay, it's completely gone. What we think right now is that this is actually a lot of electronic transitions that we remove more and more and more electrons. This has been done on xenon out of the 3D levels. They decay basically. You can ionize up to a few 20, a few 20 plus the xenon, and then you basically your scattering cross section decreases too much to really give an appreciable signal on this time scale. No, I mean we did to some degree, but it's. Getting the data was rather tough, so we are happy that we have this. So, the X-ray wavelength is about 1.5 kilovolts.
But that's just a probe.
Yeah, it's just a probe. Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Whatever the laser does.
It's also, I want to point out, what's really strange here is the time scales, right? We have a 50 femtosecond pulse, we have a 70 femtosecond pulse, so it's not like what we, especially by at this delay, we can exclude effects such as the infrared pumps and pumps and pumps and pumps, and then we just need to come late enough to see the effect of the infrared. No, the infrared is really just a short bang. It's just really ionizing the cluster, and the FEL is kind of probing it. It's about 20 nanometers, let's say up to a million atoms. Okay, I should say these are three random shots, so of course you always have a variation of particle size, right? But also if you could argue that this cluster here, like, again, it's random shots, but this one is obviously a little bigger than this one, just from the scattering. I mean, if you just integrate the signal, right, you could argue it's fading. I mean, it's also the, basically, this is all coming back now, right? If you've earlier concluded we explode off the surface And most of the atoms stay actually in the core. I mean, like the if most of the atoms stay in the core and they go in a hydrodynamic expansion, the core should be still here because the hydrodynamic timescales are rather slow, right? That's picoseconds. That's kind of actually what we tried to see, that surface explodes off. You see perhaps a little smaller cluster, and then we see something like that's actually a good question right now. So it's, I have to look. I come back to you later. It's a few degrees. Do you remember what the first detector had, an angle? Yeah. The first one? Yeah. Also, these images are cut actually. So I would I guess 20, 30 degrees perhaps. Yeah. Actually, it was rather far away. I get back to you later. I actually have to.
So the resolution is comparable with the initial size of the object. It's not a lot higher.
Yeah.
So when the object then expands, it becomes very large in comparison to the resolution.
I agree, but the
scattered like a small object.
Okay, if you.
Where all the particles scatter.
Yeah. I mean, basically, what we, just looking at the data so far. We didn't, if you just average more from this picture to this picture, right, we didn't really seem to see, on average, a big change in the ring structure, meaning that the object itself didn't really seem to change its geometric structure too much. It's, and then just doubling this from here to here, it's so again, it's like, it's the second mystery. And you remind me that my time's up and we're somewhat in the discussion, but I also have good news, I'm done. So I hope I could, in the last 30 minutes, show you that actually for intense radiation matter interaction going towards X-rays, the physics really change. We go basically from plasma type absorption going to smaller and smaller wavelengths, from plasma type absorption to multi-step ionization, plus additional effects in the superatomic density plasmas. Nanoplasma recombination, definitely is a big effect, and at this energy, so you basically like you trap the electrons rather quickly in your Coulomb potential, and then you basically go to different dynamics of the cluster expansion. Single shot scattering from single clusters is feasible, and scatter data yields, in our opinion, or in our interpretation right now, electronic structure information on actually transient timescales or on transient states on the timescales of the pulse. And what we really think, and that's the main conclusion, that there's lots of exciting physics ahead of us. And I want to just use very quickly the opportunity to thank all my coworkers, and particularly my old group at TU Berlin and all these wonderful PhD students that are still happily coming to Stanford on a regular basis to continue their work. A lot of people at DESY helped us. We have a great collaboration with a lot of theoreticians. The University of Rostock people around Karl-Heinz Mavis Bohr, Mark Ruckings group helped us in various flash ventures. And then, of course, the whole Max Planck's advanced study group / camp collaboration for a very fruitful collaboration that goes far beyond using the equipment, and also my new environment at Slack. And you for the attention. Thank you very much.
So the disappearance of the signal at long delays, could that be just a manifestation of the what's that? Poiret's law?
Poiret's law, yeah.
Yeah. So that arises from having a sharp interface, right?
Yeah.
A uniform density goes zero density. And if your cluster was developing a very diffuse, becoming more of a smooth density distribution, then you would get all your intensity disappearing out at, those rings. And so, I mean, that seems consistent with.
I don't know if it would really take away all the signal, right? I mean, what we would think actually is that you start getting a smearing, like basically that your scattering pattern starts smearing, that basically the peak to valley ratios changes, and that you basically get a wide distribution of an object. I have especially on this time scales, right? I mean, considering that it's a rather large cluster, so let's say it's about 1 million atoms, the charge imbalance will take perhaps away 10% of your atoms. You still have 900,000. It still is sizable clusters. And
right, but and you said
we basically, even if it smears out, it's a sizable cluster that expands on a rather slow time scales to our current understanding right now. So let's say picoseconds. I mean, in the beginning, actually, we also looked at picoseconds, and we didn't really see anything. And then time was clicking, so we went picoseconds. We went back to the zero. We said, it's there. Our experiment is still working. We went to 1 picosecond. We went back, and then we said, OK, let's scan really around the short time delays, and this is where we found this effect.
Well, we can talk about it.
Again, it still needs. I also have to say this data is a few weeks old, so.
Well, there was an idea that you get an instantaneously created uniform plasma, which, because it's uniform spatially, doesn't diffract. I think Stefan's here who can tell us the answer. He's the authority. Yeah. How are you going? Do you get a uniform plasma?
Okay, I just wanted to follow this the trail of thought that Veit raised and ask, what is the little trapezoidal-shaped pink box? So if Veit is correct, then what happens is all the scattering ends up in the forward direction. And you don't lose the integral, you just lose the range, right? Right. And the oscillations at large Q will fade, but the stuff in the middle will stay. So the answer is concerned what's in the center. So what's this trapezoidal thing?
Yeah. This is basically the first maxima. And then the one to the left is actually a hole in the detector. Yeah, we have a gap. So basically, this is what the yellow line. I mean, it's
so Q equals zero is not on that plot.
Q equals zero is not on the plot. It starts at about a degree of scattering angle, so we have to do the Q.
And that's too small to reach because of.
It's basically what this is the so the detector basically designed. So okay, this little black spot here, that's actually a hole in the detector. So it's designed to get the forward beam going through. What we did is actually, because we had to put filters in for the FEL and so on and so forth, we drove this hole a little out of the center so we actually could get more of the small angle scattering. And I think it's.
So Christoph, I think you diffract mostly from bound electrons, right?
Yes.
And not the inner shells because it's one or two keVs, but some whatever, third shell or whatever, second shell, xenon, right?
Yeah, so basically it's like the 3D and upward.
Okay. And so my hypothesis would be that essentially you empty these shells in the way, and then you don't have anything.
That's
to
what I meant.
From,
that's
right?
What I meant earlier. We think it's electronic transition, so we really.
That's right.
Excited all up. So we think it's actually. I mean.
So you get your electrons delocalized,
and they don't scatter
still
anymore.
Around, but they don't scatter anymore.
Yeah. So. Yes, actually, the infrared ghost like produces charge states up to comparable what we do with the FEL. So it's.
Yes.
What do you mean for short pulses? I mean we have the reference spectra from the IR, so it's easily going to xenon 20 plus. So it is a rather strong, pump actually. So. So, but that was also kind of the idea. So the IR is tuned to produce a similar charge distribution as the FEL under these conditions. So what we think right now is also, I mean, if you see something like this in the first step, you think geometry, right? Like a cluster expands and so on and so forth. Expansion is rather slow, especially if you have a hydrodynamic expansion. Of course, the edges get smooth and less defined. But what I want to point out, actually, like going from here to here, and I mean, we have seen more and more pictures. These are just three of them, but the center of gravity of the ring seems to kind of stay, right? Even if you would go in between, But what really happens is that you can even see from here to here already it's weaker, from this maximum to this maximum. It's just, it seems to just drop down. So we think it's actually the electronic excitation, which again, it's also coming back to what Linda did on just an atom, again tells you something, how important actually electronic transitions are for your scattering process.
Well,
obviously.
Let's thank the speaker again. And I'm pleased to introduce an old friend, Dick Lee from Lawrence Livermore National Lab, who is going to tell us about fourth generation X-ray light sources, applications for high energy density science.